Good afternoon, I'm Allison Bechtesh, and this is Aspen Public Radio's live broadcast of the McCloskey Speaker Series. Today, a Democratic Governor's Panel, uniting a divided nation, starting with the states. While the nation continues to be divided among party lines, governors can play a pivotal role in building discourse within their communities. A panel of Democratic governors will discuss how their innovative solutions to issues like job creation, healthcare, and immigration are serving each one of their constituents and helping move the collective forward. The discussion features Governor Steve Bullock of Montana, John Bel Edwards of Louisiana, Hickenlooper of Colorado, Jay Inslee of Washington, and Daniel Malloy of Connecticut. The broadcast will begin in just a few minutes. Support for this live broadcast of the McCloskey Speaker Series comes from Penny Evans Caruth with Aspen Snowmass Sotheby's, opening doors for buyers and sellers in the Roaring Fork Valley. Learn more at pennycaruth.com. You'll be able to listen to this discussion later tonight on our website, aspenpublicradio.org. Support for Aspen Public Radio comes from the Pitkin County Library, offering Literature Out Loud, an hour of dramatic readings by local actors, presented on the third Sunday of every month at 3 p.m. More information at pitcolib.org. Library updates are also available on Twitter and Facebook. From Avalanche Ranch Cabins in Hot Springs, a family-owned resort near Redstone for more than 50 years, three thermal hot springs pools open 9 to 5 daily, with reservations around the clock for lodging guests. Cabins, gift shop, and hot springs are open year-round. More at avalancheranch.com. Again, we expect to get started in just a minute with a live broadcast of the McCloskey Speaker Series Democratic Governors Panel, Uniting a Divided Nation, Starting with the States. This is Aspen Public Radio. Thanks for tuning in. Support for Aspen Public Radio comes from the Aspen Music Festival and School, presenting pianist Vladimir Feltzman playing Grieg's Piano Concerto with the Aspen Festival Orchestra. Also on the program, Debussy's La Mer, Sunday, August 12th at 4 p.m. at the Benedict Music Tent. More at aspenmusicfestival.com. We go now to the McCloskey Speaker Series Democratic Governors Panel, Uniting a Divided Nation, Starting with the States. Thanks for tuning in.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you could take your seats, please. We're going to get started as soon as we can. Good afternoon. I'm Elliot Gerson, Executive Vice President of the Aspen Institute, and I'd like to welcome all of you to our final event of the wonderful series that we thank Tom and Bonnie McCloskey for their sponsorship for. It's absolutely great to see such a large crowd here today. A special welcome to the always very engaged listeners on Aspen Public Radio. And our opportunity now is to hear from five Democratic governors on their insights, their successes, and their challenges in leading their states in 2018. A time I think many of us have noted in many contexts over the course of the summer of extraordinary dysfunction in our federal government, but on the other hand, really generally remarkable success at in so many states, in so many cities, whether they're red cities and states, blue or purple. And we'll probably talk a little bit about why it is that we have such a difference in the degree of public confidence and degrees of partisanship or bipartisanship at different levels of our government. So you have your introduction, you have biographies in your program, but we have a lot of people listening, so I'm just going to very quickly introduce our very distinguished panel. First, we welcome Governor Steve Bullock of Montana, who is part of the Aspen family. He's part of the Aspen family as he is one of our very distinguished Rodel Fellows. Prior to be elected governor, he served as Montana's Attorney General. As governor of Montana, he is focused on equalizing pay inequities, maintaining tuition rates at Montana colleges and universities, and securing historic levels of public funding for the state's public schools. He received his undergraduate degree from Claremont McKenna and his law degree from Columbia. I'd like to welcome Governor John Bel Edwards of Louisiana, a West Point graduate. He served 8 years as an airborne ranger on active duty with the U.S. Army, commanded a rifle company in the 82nd Airborne. He graduated from LSU Law School and went on to serve in the Louisiana House of Representatives before becoming governor. He has been a passionate champion for measures to lift Louisiana's least advantaged children and their families out of cycles of poverty. And of course, I'd like to welcome our own Governor John Hickenlooper, who is part of the Institute family for, well, lots of reasons, seems to come to lots of our programs. It may also be, I can't really imagine why else he would come to this little out-of-the-way rural town as often as he does. He served as mayor of Denver, and his work to create an extraordinarily pro-business state government, but at the same time with the highest environmental and ethical standards. He's had great bipartisan success in this state and nationally, and we look forward to hearing more about that. Also, a great pleasure to welcome back to this stage Governor Jay Inslee of Washington. Who has served in his state's House of Representatives and then in Congress. He co-wrote a book, Apollo's Fire, Igniting America's Clean Energy Economy, about a national program to fight climate change through clean energy innovation and job creation. He has both law degree, economics degree, and is focused especially on growing Washington's innovative industries such as clean energy, information technology, and life sciences. And last but not least, it's my great pleasure to welcome my home state governor, Dan Malloy of Connecticut. Governor Malloy is focused on job creation, improving public education, stabilizing the state's finances, making investments in the state's transportation infrastructure, and protecting the environment. He was born and raised in Stamford, and he served there as the city's longest-serving mayor for 14 years. Governor Malloy, it's a great pleasure to have you here. So, these gentlemen, and I must make an awkward admission, we are uncomfortable about this, you know, not very gender diverse group of people in front of you. We did ask female governors, but to no avail. We ask all of you to go back home and make sure we have more female governors so we can have a more diverse group here on this stage, but not necessarily replacing any of the ones here on this stage. And just to anticipate a question from the audience later, we did ask for representatives of the Republican governors to speak this year. They were here. They had no time for public events. We hope to have them again next year. We did, however, have in this Greenwald Pavilion earlier in the summer a wonderful program involving prominent Republicans talking about the future of the Republican Party. So we are very conscious of our obligation to be nonpartisan in our presentations. And so let me just jump right in. What I'm going to do is try to touch upon lots of different issues. I know there are many issues that all of you would like to hear these extraordinary leaders talk about. I'll probably ask one of them. Maybe someone else will jump in. We'll cover quite a few things, and then we will turn things to the audience. We have a little bit more time than usual today because of the size of our panel. We have a full hour and a half. At the event I mentioned where we had three prominent Republicans talking about some of the same issues we'll talk about today, one of the points that came up that was frankly shocking to many in the audience, and it was Michael Steele of Maryland, he noted that Americans this fall are going to find out just how much their health care insurance premiums are going to increase. In Maryland, his state, premiums are expected to rise between 30 and 90% for people outside of the exchanges. So let me just start on the subject of health care. And maybe I will start here with you, Governor Edwards, because you've had such great success in your state after expanding Medicaid. I wonder if you could just explain why that makes sense and how Louisiana can afford to do that.
Well, first of all, we can't afford not to do it. But Louisiana for generations has had more than its fair share of poverty, more than its fair share of uninsured, and her health outcomes have lagged the country. And so with all those things in mind, when I took office, I knew that we were going to expand Medicaid, because when someone is uninsured, it costs the state of Louisiana 40 cents on the dollar to provide their care. But when we insure them through the Medicaid expansion, it never costs more than 10 cents on the dollar for the coverage. And it is simple arithmetic. And so we've been able to expand coverage for 470,000 working poor people. The uninsured rate declined from 24%, almost 1 in 4, to less than 1 in 10. And we are making a positive difference in our state. I will tell you, we're saving countless lives because people now, rather than going to the emergency room for routine care, they can see primary care physicians. They can get diagnostic evaluations. If they've got a disease, they learn that before it's too late. Whereas the emergency room is the very worst place to try to manage disease. It costs more, and it's not as effective. So in a state like Louisiana, it was the right thing to do. And I will tell you, it is very popular in our state. There's almost no pushback, even with a Republican majority legislature in both the House and the Senate. There's not a lot of pushback. And by the way, overlay a map of the United States, look at the southern states, and look at where rural hospitals have closed, and look at the states that have expanded Medicaid. I have not had a single hospital closure in the state of Louisiana.
You know, healthcare, thank you. Healthcare is such an important issue. Let me just open this to anyone else to talk about the things that you do in particular to improve either quality or access or cost.
I mean, I'd add at least part of this when your earlier speaker said, oh, insurance rates are going up so much. If we're honest, last year the real effort was to, and they said it unclearly, sabotage the Affordable Care Act. So the uncertainty that happens in the market when there's going to be like cost-sharing reductions paid. That's one of the differences, I think, between Washington, D.C. and where the states are, because Governor Hickenlooper was a big part of the lead, but we had four Democratic governors, four Republican governors, the one independent in Alaska, all coming together and saying, there are ways to move forward to stabilize this market. And that's not ripping health insurance away from folks. And even to the point of where we are today, you know, there's a lot of the states saying, well, what we need to do is put in work requirements for Medicaid. What we would find out and what we see where that happens is you end up dropping about 40% of the folks on Medicaid. Now, if you look at Montana as an example, 8 out of the 10 folks, and we expand Medicaid as well, 8 out of the 10 people on Medicaid are actually already working. And what we did is we tiered our partner at our Department of Labor with our Medicaid expansion, our new enrollees, and said, just reach out and say, what are the barriers to actually you climbing up that economic ladder? We had a 9% increase in Medicaid workforce participation. So if we really want to look at ways to penalize people or to cause greater uncertainty in the market, that's what's happened in part. But governors are on the ground, and we have to work with this.
Let's. Would anyone else like just to comment in particular, given Governor Malloy?
Just very quickly, on the point of increasing cost, if we're talking about the Medicaid, excuse me, if we're talking about the folks who are buying their insurance on the exchange, people on the exchange in Connecticut would not have seen any increase this year, but for the changes that the president has made in Washington. That's not universally true. There were some variations, but by and large, the increased cost associated was at the inflation rate.
So let's turn to job creation and the economy and what you as governors can do. And Governor Hickenlooper, you've had enormous success in igniting the economy of this state, especially looking at the tech sector, but other sectors as well. Tell us a little bit about what your formula has been, and then I want to ask you a follow-up. But I'll do that right now about the trade negotiations that the president is entertaining, and how you as a governor of a state can be champions of trade in the context of what's happening in Washington, because trade's been so important for Colorado.
Absolutely, and we came in and we wanted to be. To change Colorado's identity from being just not a place to come for beautiful mountains and resort vacations, but a place that young entrepreneurs would want to come and not just build a business, but build a life. So we focused and pushed as hard as we could to cut red tape. We went through all 24,000 rules and regulations and eliminated or simplified half of them. We expanded access to capital. We marketed the state with some of our tourism dollars to entrepreneurs and young millennial professionals, trying to make it a pro-business state with the highest environmental ethics and the highest highest environmental standards and the highest ethical standards. And that we started with the bottom up. We went to every county and asked them what kind of an economy they imagined they wanted to see, and then what did they need from the state. So we did all that, and in a weird way, it worked. Maybe in some cases, it worked more than we anticipated. Now we've got a lot of problems with affordable housing and transportation infrastructure, but those are better problems to have. I got laid off in 1986, and I was out of work for almost 2 years, and that's a whole different problem to attack. In terms of the trade, again, I'm not saying that we had the right trade deals, and they certainly needed to be improved. I don't think there's any question, but we have gone so far in the other direction, and governors, we are on the ground on this, right? We see. So I was talking to an executive, a moderate size, not a giant company, but an electronics company, right? And they're going to see a hit just because this stuff is assembled all, some of it's in the United States, some of it's in Mexico, some of it's in Asia. These components move around. And how do you decide? They basically tax all of it. And they're going to have to take, supply chains, right? A whole sequence of places where products get put together, they're going to have to disrupt their supply chain. They're going to see an 8 or 10% reduction in their bottom line. I mean, think about that. 8 or 10%, they've done nothing wrong. They've competed internationally. They're doing everything right. And suddenly, they're going to go have a much steeper hill to go up. And once they change their supply chain, right, it's very hard to go back. I mean, they're going to hold off for 6 months and see if there's some sanity. But you look at agricultural products, beef and grain, and those sequences and supply chains. You look at you think it's not much that affects you in the middle of the country, and that's completely wrong. We have immense liability. And so what we've done, I think, and I speak for all of us, is tried to reach out to our businesses and give them a voice. And work in conjunction with our congressional leaders, our senators, and get the business people to put out in real numbers what it's going to cost their business, because it's much larger than what you're seeing reported.
Governor Inslee, let me ask you to comment on this as well. You have tried to make Washington really a center of innovation. Your own work and passion about climate change and energy efficiency. What are some of the things that you have done that have been particularly effective in terms of job creation in the state of Washington?
Well, the single most important thing we have done and that we are doing and that we are going to do is to remove from office everywhere we can the Republicans who have enabled Donald Trump's insane economic positions. And this is the single most important thing we're doing right now. And I say that in a nonpartisan, bipartisan way, of course. And it's serious. Look, we've got a person in the White House right now, every day, every single day, comes out with a new proposal that damages our states in real-time ways. We can't sell an apple in Asia or a cherry in Asia right now. We got apples on ships in Pacific Ocean. We don't ever know where they are going to go. So number one, that's our number one responsibility. Number two, we, and we've all done this to some degree, we really have blown up a Republican myth. And this is a fundamental part of this discussion, I think. The Republican myth is that if you treat working people fairly, if you have educational policies that will help everyone get a shot at education, if you will give people some clean air and clean water, by the nature of those actions, you will retard economic growth. We have blown up that fundamental myth. So let me ask you this question. What do you get when you have a state that has adopted the best voter rights bills in the United States? That's Washington. The first state with statutory net neutrality protection, that's Washington. Reproductive Parity Act to make sure women's rights are protected. Finally, financing our K-12 system as we have done. New gender equity provisions and a climate change provision that is dedicated to giving our kids what they deserve, which is clean air and a world that isn't destroyed by climate change. What do you get? You get the best economy in the United States 3 out of the last 3 years, depending on who you listen to, and that's the state of Washington. And there's a reason for this. There's a reason for this, and John talked about it a little bit. The secret of economic growth is no longer below our feet in natural resources. It is above our shoulders in intellectual talent. And when you build a state that is a great place to recruit a computer programmer or a physicist or a person developing a new clean energy source, the best place to live makes you the best economic competitor. And that's why we have 65,000 people moving into my state. And that's what we're all doing in some degree, and I'm just proud to be up here. You look at what John Bell's done on healthcare, what Steve's done on before the Bell stuff, what John's done on career-connected learning, which we're both doing some great work on, what Dan is doing to get his people to be safe. We've blown up the Republican myth, and I'm proud to be a Democrat governor.
Thank you. I don't know, but that wind may be the force of a Trump tweet at the moment. Let's just go move from Washington to Montana, move a little east, a little redder, and where there's a great deal of support for the president. And one thing that we frequently read analysis is about how many people in rural America feel left out of the economy, and that they don't have the same opportunities, and they feel that they have been let down. And the president has clearly exploited those fears and anxieties. And I wonder how you relate to that as a governor of a largely rural state.
Yeah, and I do think he has exploited that without candidly offering much to rural America and much of America. I got reelected when Donald Trump took Montana by 20 points. I won by 4 points, the only Democrat in the country to get reelected in a state where Donald Trump won. And it's not that we haven't been doing progressive things along the way to get folks there. I mean, I think that we really have to recognize, like one of my favorite quotes, it was in the New York Times, this was 2 years ago, it says, Silicon Valley gets all the credit, but the real hotbed of American entrepreneurial activity lies a few hundred miles to the northeast, Bozeman, Montana. And what I loved about it, somebody from New York would think that Montana and San Francisco are only 300 miles apart. And so, I mean, two things. Like, I could take you to one of the poorest, 100 poorest counties in America. It's Wheatland County, Harlan, Montana, and Ticket River Printing is an online printing business, the second largest in the nation, out of this community. And could also take you to where we've tried to turn around and say, and I think every governor up here has done that too, is said, look,
not everybody's even going to get a college degree. What we need to do is get those professionally recognized certificates and credentials so that folks can climb that economic ladder, and that's urban and rural. And as a result, I mean, we've refigured what our two-year colleges are, registered apprenticeships. We used to think it's just welders, 1,000 different apprenticeable fields. So there's a lot of ways to actually address some of the challenges that we have. But what we see in some respects is, and I mean, I agree with the premise of your question, that tried to say, well, wait a minute, you guys aren't getting ahead, so let's start pointing fingers at other people or other countries, as opposed to saying, how do we bring everybody up? And I think that there are real possibilities, and you're seeing it in a lot of rural areas. Back to your earlier question, though, that if, like, my wheat farmers, price of wheat's down 20%. Healthcare and trade have been more dictated by statements and tweets than any thoughtful policy. And I think that's part of what sort of builds further on that urban-rural divide.
Let me go back to Connecticut and Governor Malloy. You know, we talked a little bit about the urban-rural divide, but one other thing we sense, and we've heard a lot about this over the summer as well, is just widespread loss of faith in government. And the statistics are absolutely shocking, you know, how little faith people have in Congress, in the federal government. But those same polls show a very different story in many states and cities. And I wonder, Governor, what you do and how you relate to this, and you're very popular in your state. Most people in the state, including Republicans and independents, feel the state government is doing a good job. Why such faith in your state government, in many state and local governments, and not in federal government?
We have to be careful to not mix people's complaints about their lack of faith in government. When someone gets in trouble, the first place they turn is government. So we live in a society where we're all very likely to be critical of government when we don't need it, and when we do need it, then complain that it's not giving us enough. So I think, and then we have a guy in the White House who's made a career, not just while he's president, not just while he was running for president, but quite frankly, throughout his business career on telling people very effectively that government doesn't do anything for them. But, you know, we had a discussion about healthcare just a few moments ago, and we would not be where we are on healthcare, making it, if not universal, far closer to universal access because of government, and quite frankly, because of the Congress and President Obama doing what they did, and quite frankly, being willing to pay a price, and a lot of congressmen and senators were willing to do that. I do think people like, you know, this is, people like their town that they live in. They have a reason to like it because they're, you know, they got a house there, or they got an apartment, or they're living there, and no one wants to live in a place that they don't embrace, and states, I think, to a larger extent, gets covered that way as well. Although there's more reasons to complain about state government and complain about your state than there might be about your local government. But I think ultimately we have come through a very long period of time in which the middle class suffered, while you know, wealthy people did extremely well. And I don't think you can separate the dissatisfaction of the middle class and poorer individuals from the fact that they're seeing changes in their society, but those changes aren't necessarily positively affecting them, sans perhaps access to health care. So I think that it's a tough thing to do. You know, a couple of quick things. I'm not all that popular in my state because people won't acknowledge that we've grown a substantial number of jobs. Our people will say, well, you know, large companies have left the state. Well, there are more Fortune 500 companies in Connecticut today than the day I got elected. But if you asked a question about that, people would say no, because politics themselves have become extremely negative. And if you want to make a point, you do it in a negative way, not in a positive way. And I think that has a reflection. And then the final point I'll make is that what we've seen play out in Washington over the last 20 years has come to state government in a larger way than we like to admit. The gridlock that does tie up more progress from being made in state capitals has its roots in Washington-based politics.
Well, let's just stay on that for a minute. Maybe Governor Edwards will start with you, and that's the hyper-partisanship we see in Washington that has made Congress so dysfunctional and has made people so unhappy with Washington. And as Governor Malloy says, it does carry down to the state level. But, you know, you have a highly partisan state, yet you've had considerable success. What is the difference between, the dysfunctional hyper-partisanship in Washington and what happens, for example, in your state and how you navigate those straits?
It's my charisma. Yeah. No. Look, I was trying to be funny. I identify with what Dan just said and really what Steve just said. 11 months after I won with 56% of the vote in Louisiana, Donald Trump carried our state with 58%. I know that there were a lot of people who voted for me less than a year later voted for Donald Trump. And that makes me scratch my head, but I know that folks are just anxious. I'm gonna say one of the things that really is gripping our state and our country and causing dysfunction is this hyper-partisanship. And we ought to try to not vilify one another and speak of folks and just attach to them the most awful label that we can think of. You know, I don't ever talk about Donald Trump supporters as being crazy or racist. And look, there might be some like that, but that doesn't explain what happened in Louisiana. We're better than that. But I will tell you, it is creeping that this partisanship is coming to states everywhere in a way that really does not bode well for our future. And part of it is because you have money that is coming from out of the state in huge numbers to influence people and to scare legislators. If they don't take that Republican philosophy as it is espoused in Washington and practice it in Louisiana, that they're going to have dollars spent against them in a local election. And we're fighting against that, and we're having some success, but it is much harder than it ought to be. It is a tough situation. We are still fortunate in Louisiana. We have legislature that's majority Republican, but we have committee chairmen, for example, in both the House and the Senate who are Democrats. We are still much less partisan than elsewhere, and I think it's helpful to us. But we are going down the road that you just talked about.
Well, let's hope we could turn around on that road. Governor Bullock, what do you...
Yeah, I'd only add... So my legislature is almost two-thirds Republican, yet we expanded Medicaid, record investments in K through 20, first-time investments in publicly funded preschool, earned income tax credit. Like, we've actually been able to say, let's not talk about the partisanship, let's talk about what folks want. What do they need? Decent education system, clean air, clean water, good job, a safe community, belief you can do better for your kids or grandkids. If those are the values we're talking about, most people would agree. But if you translate, and I also agree with John Bell that it's now coming down the state level, the single worst thing that happened to representative democracy in the last decade is the Citizens United decision. And I could go on for a long time about work we've been doing on that, but that has fundamentally changed what happens in Washington, D.C., and it is now more and more impacting states as well. And that's where I think it is very concerning where we're going, but I do also think that there's some steps we can take along the way.
Let's talk about, as governors, you still have to work with the White House on many things. You're all Democrats. It's a hyper-partisan environment. What are those conversations like? And Governor Inslee, let me ask you. We just heard your views on the president in one context. You need to talk to him sometimes too. Tell us how you can still cooperate with the president on common issues.
Well, I think you need to show the appropriate civility and and at the same time strength of your position. And just to show you how far I go on that, yesterday I invited the president to come campaign in the state of Washington for the Republicans. And I... And I will tell you, if he accepts my invitation, I will greet him at SeaTac Airport with 12 Dreamers and a box of Washington apples that we can't sell anywhere, so I might as well give them to him. So I've actually only had one conversation with the president. We were there talking mostly about the gun safety issue, and at the time the president had proposed arming first grade teachers with Glocks on their hips, and I thought that was a really poor idea. And the reason is because I listened to teachers and they told me that was a spectacularly poor idea. So when I went there, we had a chance to have a little interchange, and I expressed that concept that we really need to listen to the educators about what really works. And I did gently suggest to him that it might not be a bad idea to tweet a little less and listen a little more to the teachers, and I thought that was a good idea. So, you know, we have those interchanges. But the difficulty is I'm not sensing that we have a person who listens to kind of anybody in the White House, frankly, much less Democratic governors. And that's why we have such chaos. And it is chaos. And it is destructive. Just one thing that's on the top of my mind, I'll mention it. About 3 days ago, they said that they think this year might have been the hottest year in the history of the human species. And that very same day, the president announced that he was going to basically slash our auto emission standards that allow us to fight climate change with carbon emissions. Now, I couldn't think of a more damaging irony of that juxtaposition. Now, talking to him probably isn't going to solve that problem, but here's the secret of Democratic governors, and all of us share this experience. There's one thing you know about Donald Trump. He cannot stop us doing what we're doing in our own states. He cannot stop us. He cannot stop me from establishing a clean energy research center and putting a lid on carbon dioxide emissions. He can't stop me from passing a bipartisan infrastructure bill. And by the way, they haven't built a birdhouse in D.C. We had the biggest infrastructure package in the history, where we had the greenest infrastructure package, where we can reduce CO2 emissions from our transportation system. So the point about this year, and we're encouraging people to think about electing Democratic governors, is this is the place we can make progress, is in these governors' offices. John Bel Edwards on health care, John on apprenticeships. This is where we can make progress. And I know people have talked about 2020 and everything. Look, we got to win this in 2018 so we can start making progress this year in the United States, governor by governor, and I hope people will do that.
Governor, let me just stay with you on this. You said that the president can't stop you as a governor from doing things. You've actually, as a governor, tried to stop him from doing a number of things, and you, if I think I'm correct, have actually sued the federal government over things like the Muslim ban on the child separation policy. So tell us what your philosophy is there.
If you haven't sued Donald Trump by noon Monday, you're not doing your job. That's the way I kind of look at it. And I do, I mean, I remember I was getting on my bike to go for a bike ride months ago, and my chief of staff called me and said, hey, they're stopping people at SeaTac International Airport from coming into the country. Scientists who are going to a Microsoft health conference internationally because they're Muslim, they're stopping them. And so I got off my bike and went down to SeaTac just to help these families, and literally saw one guy as a scientist. He was 50 feet from hugging his wife, and they wouldn't let him into the country. We had that moral outrage across the country, actually Republicans and Democrats alike. And now when we have seen him putting children in cages, we understand the depths of depravity and cruelty. So one of the benefits of being governor is that we can enter as litigants in the judicial system, and we have won about 80% of our cases to date. I'm proud of our Attorney General, Bob Ferguson, who I've worked with. For instance, he led this 12-state consortium to sue on the child separation policy. And by the way, it's simply dastardly that he still has not connected hundreds of these children with their parents. Comfortable in the United States. So this is one advantage of being governors, and we're going to stay on him.
Governor Malloy, Governor Inslee mentioned in his previous question the subject of gun control or gun issues. As the governor of the state where the Sandy Hook horrific shooting took place, and as someone who has been a leader nationally in bipartisan gun safety, it wasn't easy, even in Connecticut, even after that. But can you just tell us a little bit about, and your advice about how other states could adopt common sense gun legislation?
Well, hopefully you don't do it the way we did, right? Which is to have, you know, children killed in a school and their teachers killed in the process of attempting to protect them. Hopefully more and more states recognize that you can respect our Constitution and the amendments there too, at the same time that you can make people safer. And if you need an example of having done that, Connecticut is that example. In the last 4 years, we've reduced violent crime more than any other state by 30%. And a portion of that is because we adopted, I think, we had relatively strong laws, but we adopted stronger laws. We had relatively good access to mental health treatment, but we expanded access to mental health treatment. We've done a lot of other things on the criminal justice side, which I'm happy to talk about. But on the gun side, it isn't easy. I mean, I talked about Washington coming to state capitals. I put forward a bill that would ban ghost guns. Guns made in parts to be assembled elsewhere. Without a serial number. And how do you trace a gun without a serial number? And that would have. Given all of the circumstances that have played out in Connecticut, that should have sailed through the legislature. And yet it wasn't called for a vote. It wasn't called for a vote in a state where 20 children and 6 adults were slaughtered in an elementary school. So, yeah, we had great success in 12, and we have everyone who takes credit for Connecticut being safer and having lower crime and all the rest. But when it came to taking the next positive step that you could take, Washington politics played a very large role. Nobody wants to be on the losing end of a battle with the NRA. No one wants to be, if you're a Republican, no one wants to be on the other side of an argument with Donald Trump. And I think that was evidenced in many ways over the last couple of weeks in primaries. There's one other point I do want to make with respect to the prior discussion, and that is, you know, the Republican Party was the party of rule of law. I mean, the rule of law was more often under attack by Democrats over the last 100 years than it was the Republican Party. And yet, as I sit here today, the Democratic Party is the party that is arguing the rule of law. You've brought lawsuits. We've all brought lawsuits, or most of us have brought lawsuits. You know, we had the first family ordered by the court to be reunited. In fact, the judge said, you bring that family, those parents, or that parent to New Haven, and they're going to be united in our courthouse. Because the Trump administration understands rule of law, they didn't want a precedent set. They actually reunited the family before they got to court so that the standard that was applied by the judge wouldn't be universally applied elsewhere in the country. They're very smart about their ignorance of the rule of law. And so it's a very big problem, and it plays itself out over many, many issues, and I think guns are one of those. Yes, we've been successful. Yes, we're safer. Yes, we have stronger possibilities of making ourselves safer, and yet we have a president who thinks it was a good idea that people should be able to download programs to manufacture guns on a instrument that no one 20 years ago would have predicted could do that, and certainly no one who was a signer to the Constitution thought was a possibility when they guaranteed certain rights, not every right. We don't have a right to have a tank the last time I checked.
Governor Edwards, for many years, Louisiana, I think, led the country with the highest incarceration rate of any state in the country. Last year, though, you spearheaded an effort to pass criminal justice reform in Louisiana. And I think I'm right that just yesterday we asked earlier, you know, about contacts directly with the president. You met with President Trump in New Jersey. Can you just tell us, you know, how you accomplished that legislative feat in Louisiana, what your recommendations would be, and how you got along with the president?
Okay, so this is how we did it. We knew that for decades we had led the country in our incarceration rate. We were locking up people at twice the national average, but we were not safer. Our crime rate didn't reflect any progress. Recidivism was poor, 1 in 3 returning within 3 years, and we were spending $700 million a year in a state as small as Louisiana on a Department of Corrections. And it was only healthcare and higher education that were getting, or in education, were getting more money than that. So we just took a look at it and said, you know, there's got to be a better way to do this. We brought in the Pew Charitable Trust, and we were very data-driven. Everything was data-driven and objective. And we ended up, and this is really, by the way, it inspired confidence in me that if you can do this on criminal justice, you can do it in a lot of areas, although it is difficult. We brought in folks from across the spectrum. So the ACLU, the Louisiana Association for Business and Industry, the religious right, the religious left. We had judges, DAs, and sheriffs on the task force. I signed 10 bills into law a little over a year ago. We have reduced our prison population safely by focusing on nonviolent, non-sex offenders. And by the way, I can tell you for the first time in decades, today, as I said on the stage, Louisiana does not have the highest incarceration rate in the nation today. That is a distinction that we have shed. And we decided that we were going to calculate the savings, and 70% of the savings will have to go back into our criminal justice system, into reentry programs, into substance abuse treatment, mental health treatment, education training, alternatives to court. So we have diversion programs, we have specialty courts. And by the way, we're going to strengthen what we do with respect to victims of crime as well. And it has been very well received across the state of Louisiana. And the meeting with the president last night, I was there about this time yesterday in New Jersey, it was actually a thoughtful exchange. Because Congress has passed, the House of Representatives passed what they call the First Step Act with 360 votes. And he asked several governors present to compare that act with what we had done in our states and whether we thought it would work at the federal level, what might not be in that bill that should be, and that sort of thing. And we had an exchange that lasted for about 2 hours. Now, I don't know what happens going forward. But quite frankly, the meeting that I had with him last night was very, very positive. Sometimes there's not much follow through, and I mean we'll see what happens with it. But I would encourage everybody who's concerned about criminal justice reform to really reach out and see who's in favor of it, because there's a whole lot of folks out there supporting real, meaningful criminal justice reform as a way to save money, but to save lives too. Because we're sending people to prison who shouldn't be there. We should reserve prison space for dangerous criminals who pose a threat to public safety. What we found out was drug possession was the leading offense causing our incarceration rate to be what it was. And so there's a much better, smarter way to do this. And if you don't give someone a felony conviction who doesn't need it, you make it possible for him or her to support themselves and their families and get jobs. Going forward, but that felony conviction is going to forever stain them and be a limiting factor on their ability to support themselves.
Thank you.
And when you actually dig in, and I think what, you know, Governor Malloy is the first person who talked about this stuff in a really powerful way four years ago, I guess, and caught my attention, but John Bell has followed in that. We're all now working on various programs. We have a group in Colorado now called Defy Ventures. So I'm going down to the Arkansas Valley Correctional Facility next week for a graduation. And they went into the worst of our offenders. These are guys who have all been in over 20 years. About half of them murdered somebody. They are really tough cases. And they go and put them through an entrepreneurial training session and make them create a business plan. And most of these guys killed somebody when they were 17 or 18 years old or 19 years old. They have been spotless. Some of them have been in prison for 40 years and have been absolutely perfect. I mean, they've clearly reformed. They found forgiveness through the church, through their own families, whatever process. But Defy goes in, and they have to stand up. I went down there, and they have a row of 80 entrepreneurs and venture capitalists and me standing in a row face-to-face with a row of 90 of these hardened criminals. And you look in there, part of the process is you look in their eyes for a full 2 minutes, you don't say anything. And then you begin relating truths about how you grew up, how old were you when you first had someone in your family killed. And everyone in that other line had someone in their family died before they were 14. Every single one. And you go and you hear the stories, and then they go around and they start giving you their business plans of what they're going to do. And the recidivism rate for Defy, they are in the two of the hardest, toughest prisons in California, two of the toughest prisons in New York. Their recidivism is 3%, right? And again, this is the worst. This is one of those, this is a blight on America. We have more people in prison in this country than China and Russia combined. It's just, and right now, our unemployment in Colorado, last summer was 2.3. Now we feel blessed it's only 2.7. I mean, we need workers, right? We need people that want to work and are willing to commit themselves. Almost, now I've talked to three employers who have taken these ex-cons, and obviously in these cases, their entrepreneurial business didn't start, but they are model workers, and they are, you know, kind of a catalyst for the spirit in the workplace for these employers. And I think there's a real argument to be made that they benefit pretty much every workplace where they go.
Governor Malloy, you've done some great work in Connecticut criminal justice reform. Do you have anything to add on that topic?
I hope so. I think we're all taking this issue on because we understood that at its very heart, to be 5% of the world's population, that's what we are in the United States, and to have 25% of the individuals incarcerated be Americans makes no sense. We followed a policy that was not based on reality and certainly was not based on statistics. There were periods in the 1990s through the early 2000s where in the United States a new prison was opening every week. Do you know how expensive that is? I know for instance, to put somebody up in a prison or jail in Connecticut on a daily basis is $170 a day. But as I sit before you, we have 7,000 fewer people in prison in Connecticut than we had just a few years ago. And we have the lowest crime rate we've experienced in over 50 years. Our recidivism rate has dropped. Our assaults on corrections officers have dropped. Our assaults by prisoners against prisoners have dropped. You started the whole program by saying that you were bemoaning that we're not joined by a female governor. On this particular point, I'm joined by my wife. So we've done this together. In fact, Kathy's here, and we sponsored, because Kathy made me do it. We had the first conference in the United States on criminal justice reform, and including prison reform, in a prison just a couple of months ago. And it was a remarkable day in which we could celebrate how far we've come, but quite frankly, how far we have to go. Final point I'll make. We have to stop incarcerating young people. And I will tell you why. Someone came to me years into our drive to lower crime and to change our criminal justice system and said, hey, Governor, we've crossed the line. We have 60% fewer young people in prison than we had previously been sending to prison. 60% under the age of 21 being incarcerated. I said, give me the statistic on people over the age of 21 who were incarcerated in Connecticut prisons before the age of 21. So look at everybody incarcerated after. What percentage is that? 75% of the prison population had been incarcerated before they were 21 years old. It makes no sense. It guarantees people, well, You can, there is a percentage of people can overcome it, but it nearly guarantees that you will have a life in which you can't get a decent place to live, you can't get a decent education, you can't get a Pell Grant to finish your education if you had started it, and you can't get a decent job. We are literally cutting off our nose to spite our face. And so what we've done in Connecticut, and this is something that John's talking about, is we've created a program to train people while they're in prison for the job that they're going to have. We have thousands of unfilled, actually, Washington, Connecticut, and Kansas are the three most intensive states in aerospace. We have thousands of jobs we can't fill. So you know what we're doing? We're training people in prison to take those jobs. And you know what happens when they get out and they've been trained and they have their certificate? They get a job. And you know what happens? They don't come back because they're making a lot of money. So if we could do this on the federal level, if we could do it in more states, it would be a great thing. Quite frankly, you know, I'm a Democrat, and I came through the Koch building, and I was thinking about, but you know what? People in my state would remind me that a broken clock is right twice a day. The Kochs get it. They understand that we're spending money in the wrong way, and this is one of those issues where we could have a bipartisan approach, and we should have a bipartisan approach, but most Democrats are afraid of the issue. Because when a Democrat steps out on this particular issue in a state, what frequently happens is Republicans will then take an opposite position of what they're taking in other states. And so it is a tough issue to handle. Thank you, Kathy.
Yes, thank you. Governor Inslee.
I just want to add, I believe I put a moratorium on the death penalty. It's time to end the death penalty in the United States. And I just wanted to say that we're moving in that direction.
Well, and the Pope spoke on that as well. You're right. I mean, Charles Koch does support criminal justice reform, and criminal justice reform is a good example of where there is bipartisan support for something. But there are examples of lots of other things where there is broad public support, but for whatever reason, dysfunction in Washington moves things in another direction. And one example of that is net neutrality, which is an issue where I think significant majorities of both Republicans and Democrats have expressed their support for a free and open internet. And I just wonder what governors have done to address the public outcry that followed the FCC's appeal of net neutrality in December of last year. And you know, a number of you have been outspoken on this issue, and maybe I'll begin with you, Governor Bullock.
Yeah, it sort of underscores that all good public policy is local. I'm sitting in my office halfway through January. Assistant comes in and says, you got a phone call through the switchboard. And I'm like, okay, who is it? It's your 16-year-old daughter. I'm like, why would Caroline be calling me through the switchboard? And I go, hey, honey. She goes, hello, Governor.
Then you know you're in trouble.
Yeah. And her and her friends that day had called our two Senate offices and our congressman to say, what are you going to do, Congress, about net neutrality? It's important not just our kids. It's important to commerce. It's important to rural areas. And I said, honey, I hope you didn't leave your last name with those Senate offices. But then she said, no, Dad, what are you going to do about it? And my first answer was, nothing I can do. This is a federal issue. And that's when we dug into it. And the FCC, when they were appealed in 2016 in December, they said, well, it ought to be consumers making this decision, not some regulation. State of Montana is a consumer of internet services. So I put out an executive order that said, if you're going to sell internet services to the state of Montana, you're going to preserve net neutrality for all citizens in our state. And Montana's not the biggest state in the country, but fortunately, little tiny states like New York and New Jersey signed the same executive order. And this is another one of those areas, and so many of what you've spoken about is, and also Republican, Vermont, Governor Scott signed it. A lot of these issues where meaningful reform or impact from criminal justice reform to a 16-year-old trying to save the internet, it happens at the local level. And we don't have the luxury as governors to just say, well, it's all about speeches. We actually have to get things done. So we have about six states now that done that same executive order. We made a template so any state could use it. I know also Governor Inslee has passed legislation too. So, but I think it is one of those areas where, look, wide public support. Our millennials certainly care about it. But if you're trying to have a business in the rural part of America, you care about it. If you're inner city and that's your only internet access, it's your phone, you care about it. And it's something that we need to keep moving forward on.
Governor?
We got a lot of great things in our state, but I'm proud we're the only state that has a state statute that guarantees net neutrality to every single citizen in the state of Washington. And I'm glad we passed it. And it's obvious why we need to do this. It's obvious we need to do this to help in our privacy. It's obvious we need to do this to make sure we have access to the full breadth of the internet services. It is obvious we need to do this so that small businesses are not victimized when large ISPs strike sweetheart deals with large incumbent businesses and choke out those entrepreneurs who are building the next great idea in their garages. So net neutrality is an obvious issue. I've been working on it for 5 or 6 years since I was in Congress. And it made me heartsick that during the Obama administration, where we finally had a success, like in so many cases, in healthcare, in climate change, in net neutrality, in trying to get toxics out of our water, that this president has torn up things that are good for families. This is a family-unfriendly administration, and this is a perfect example of it. So we're happy to have this tussle with them in court. I look forward to beating them in court yet another time to preserve net neutrality. But I want to make a point about net neutrality that is a larger issue. And that is, I think we Democrats, both in governor's offices and nationally, have a mission. And that is to redefine the D in gross domestic product. When we talk about GDP right now, the word domestic right now has not referred to domestic, meaning our own families, meaning where we live. And so as GDP has gone up, but 50% of our families are not having wage growth, GDP is not serving the American people. And net neutrality is one of those small things that in combination can build an economy that works for everyone and restores income inequality in this country. So we're fighting for net neutrality. It's putting the domestic back in gross domestic product ultimately, and I'm glad we've done it.
Thank you. I think all of us who've been in Colorado much of the summer are delighted to hear this rain, even though it does interfere with the acoustics in the room. And it brings to mind the wildfire season that we've just had, Governor Hickenlooper, here in Connecticut a few weeks ago, here in Colorado a few weeks ago, sitting in this tent, we could smell the smoke from the Lake Christine fire just 15 miles down valley. Montana, you're about to have what's traditionally been your fire season. What can the states do to better prepare against what seems to be the new normal? And I'll come back more broadly on climate change and the contributions that may make to the problem. But the fire seasons are going to be longer. They're going to be more expensive. They're going to be more severe. So Governor, you have fires raging all across the state. This isn't going to be enough to stop them. What are you doing about it?
So, and we've totally transformed how we fight fires. I just want to put on one little bit to net neutrality that I couldn't squeeze in there. That part of the big issue also is how do we make sure we have broadband in every community in our states? And especially those of us that have large rural areas that are unconnected, this is the equivalent of the rural electrification plans or making sure that every ranch or farm had a telephone. This is the stock and trade. This is the currency of today. And I think all of us are committed. We'll have 90% of the state connected by the end of next year, and by 2022, we will have every town in Colorado with high-speed internet connection. So throw that in as just, you want net neutrality, and I think we're all fighting for that, but we also, even bigger than that, is to make sure everybody has equal opportunity. In terms of the fires, the key to any of these fires is to try and get to them early, right? And that's, we now have all kinds of satellite imagery. We now have in every local community, we have a fire truck and a team that is trained to respond immediately. But with climate change, it is getting drier, right? And there's no question we're going to see longer fire seasons. They're going to be more severe. In 2012, our fire season started in March, right? We had our first serious fire the second week in March, and it never let up until probably the second or third week in August. It's unprecedented in anybody's history. So part of this is training people to mitigate their damage. So in what they call the WUI, I don't mean WUI, but what you guys are thinking, I mean WUI, the wildfire urban interface, wildland urban interface, and making sure people don't have brush coming right up to their house. They don't pile their firewood up against the house. They don't have wood shake shingled roofs, because in the wildfires, we're going to have wildfires. There's almost no way that we can imagine we're really going to stop it, short of the next 50 years finally getting our arms around climate change. But we can be much better prepared, and have, if you get to a fire before it really stops, it's your best chance to stop it.
Governor Bullock.
Fire seasons now are 68 days longer than they were three decades ago. So we certainly have to talk about climate and how that's impacts overall. But go last year, I had the most expensive fire season in our state's history, 1.3 million acres burned. But let's take that up the national level. $3 billion were spent on fires last year. 67% of the Forest Service's budget, discretionary budget, through fire borrowing was used to put out those fires. So one here, if you're looking for any glimmers of hope and optimism in bipartisanship, Forest Service is broken. 10 of the last 15 years, they've actually taken money that would have been used to work in the woods, to restore watersheds, to do some cleaning up both around the WUIs and selective harvesting, and they just, all that money gets shifted over to fighting fires. But it was largely Western governors, Democrats and Republicans, in this omnibus bill, the budget bill this spring, where we said there's got to be a better way to run the railroad, because we see it in our communities where when Forest Service budgets are just about fighting fires, not trying to build any resiliency up front, the challenges that we'd have. And there were this, they've been fighting on this for about 15 years. But it was late night phone calls and emails from governors, Democrats, and Republicans all through the West that said, we need to fix this fire borrowing. I was pleased that they don't start until 2020, but they're actually going to now have dedicated dollars to take care of forest management, and they're going to start treating fires a little bit more like natural disasters. That's one step in the West that we need to do just to make sure that we can get the work done in the woods.
Governor Inslee, let me just go to you. Obviously, fighting fires seems classically a local issue or a state issue when there are wildfires crossing jurisdictions. But to the degree climate change is exacerbating that, that seems to most of us like a national issue. But what can you do, given, you know, your personal history and connection with clean energy? What can governors do if this administration is not, to say the least, committed to aggressive actions on climate change?
We can do everything, and we're doing everything. And I'll give you a little sense of optimism, confidence. And I think at this moment of high anxiety, when we see the world degradation that's going on, of ocean acidification, our forests burning, our salmon runs declining, because the water actually in Washington State is getting too hot for salmon to spawn, actually because of the water temperature. At the moment of all that anxiety that we need to feel, I think one of our goals need to be to give people some sense of confidence that we can save these forests. And we can save these forests. We can do little dibs and dabs around management. We're doing that in firefighting. But there's only one way to save these forests, and we're going to do it, which is to defeat climate change. Now, that is a mission. I've been on it for a decade and a half, and my state is now fully engaged in it. And here's why I believe we should have some confidence and optimism. Point number one, not one single nation, mayor, or governor in the entire globe has followed Donald Trump when he pulled out of Paris. Not a single one.
This is a victory for we governors, and we've started the U.S. Climate Alliance to show we can move forward as states. And we are moving forward as states. So when I went to Bonn and with Governor Brown in Paris, we wanted to assure the world that we are moving forward. Dan Malloy is moving forward. Our new governor, Phil Murphy in New Jersey, is moving forward. We got a great candidate, Michelle Lujan Grisham, who's in Aspen today, who has the best, one of the best clean energy plans I've ever seen. This is optimism because the states can move forward. Point number two, and I've believed this for so long. You noted the little book I read or wrote, excuse me, I co-authored it. By the way, the movie rights are still available if there's any movie people out there. But basically, about 7-8 years ago, I predicted that solar energy would become grid competitive, as cheap as coal, and electric cars would become mass produced, and this is happening. We are reaching scale so that regular consumers can get access to the technologies to defeat climate change, and not a moment too soon. That is a cause for optimism. Third, we are learning how to win elections on climate change. And I'm telling you, I'm going to do everything humanly possible to make sure climate change is a front burner issue in 2018 and 2020. It cannot be a back burner issue anymore. This has to be a fundamental message of the Democratic Party, because we are learning it as a winning message, and I'll tell you why. When we talk about it, we start by talking about Jasmine, who was a 14-year-old girl I met on the banks of the Duwamish, a little Latina gal who lives in a highly industrialized area. She told me she was 11 years old before she found out there were some kids that didn't have asthma. We are dedicated to ending the epidemic of asthma by defeating climate change. And this year we have an initiative on the ballot, 1631, that will create the very first charge on carbon polluters, so carbon polluters will pay to solve asthma. That's a great deal, and we're going to pass it.
Thank you. I'm just going to ask a couple more questions and then open it up. You just talked about elections and ballots. I'd like you to talk about Russian hacking. And it does not seem like there is a great sense of urgency coming out of Washington about protecting the integrity of our elections and protecting them from foreign interference. What are you doing as governors? Are there things you can do to protect the integrity of the ballots in your own state, Governor Malloy?
I want to be very, very clear that I didn't collude, and if I did, it's not a crime. So I was.
Did you say did or didn't?
So to hit this particular point, in Connecticut, we have a couple of things that we've done. We require paper ballots, and we have same-day registration. So even if you show up and someone says your name has been deleted from the rolls, you can then still cast your provisional ballot, and it will ultimately be counted unless there's some reason that it won't be, and they're aren't a whole lot of reasons. I think those are the two best instant defenses you could have in the United States on the issue of ballot tampering. On the issue of overall collusion and who affects the information we receive and what the alternative facts are advertised to be, that's an entirely different question, which is going to require a national answer to it. Except that, and this is not unlike on the climate change, there's reasons to be positive, because look what's happened to the plastic straw in the last month and a half. But on the false facts as opposed to alternative facts, we're seeing companies finally come up and say they're going to do something about the spread of that. And that's a different issue than making our own balloting system safe. But if you want to make it safe, allow people to register on the day they vote. It's a fail-safe effort, and make sure you have a paper backup to any ballot that's cast. And we do.
Anyone else? Governor Hickenlooper.
So in Colorado, we are fortunate to have Northern Command is down in Colorado Springs, so we have worked for the last several years to set up something called the National Cybersecurity Center. It has several goals. One is to make sure we train county commissioners, mayors, elected officials from all walks of life, from multiple, I think we've had 14 different states send people, because this
this issue around security of ballots has got to be a cultural change and recognize that cybersecurity, we're not going to win this battle in the next 6 months or the next 2 years or the next 10 years. It's going to be something we're going to have to be constantly vigilant. So we sat down with the Secretary of State, who's a Republican, but is absolutely committed to the same values that Governor Malloy is describing, to make sure that every person gets to vote and that vote is counted. So we have paper backup, and we're going to do total constant monitoring to make sure that there is no intrusion or anybody tampering with any vote in any way.
One last question, then I'll open it up. There have been a number of references to the midterm elections coming up. And now, you know, asking you as Democrats, we've heard many people at various sessions over the summer and in the press, especially conservative commentators, suggest that the Democratic Party is now so split between its left wing and moderates that they will not have the electoral impact that they might. And I wonder what your own perspectives are about how big and unified the Democratic tent is, and whether that's a real concern or whether that's a hope on the part of the Republican Party.
As
Governor Inslee, you're
chair of the Democratic Governors Association. I'll tackle that one. I'll just say something I totally believe. We have right now the greatest inspirational unifying leader leading this effort of unifying Democrats in the history of America, and that's Donald Trump. And I have never seen Democratic brothers and sisters be blood brothers so much any time in my history as a Democrat, and it's just a bunch of bunk. And I'll tell you, the best objective evidence of this is the way people have been voting. So in Virginia, where we had a really, really vigorous primary between candidates with some different views and Democrats, the morning afterwards, we were a united team, and Ralph won by 10 points going away, which was supposed to be a toss-up race. In Alabama, where we won, were five special elections. In Iowa, there's been five special elections for legislative seats since Donald Trump's huge inauguration crowd was there. And of those five seats, there has been an average increased performance of 20 points since 2014. Tuesday was the primaries in the state of Washington, and we have 16 incumbent Republicans who are behind their Democratic challengers right now. You are witnessing a nation that has had a bellyful of this unhinged narcissist. And there is a unified team that's going to vote this year against the people who have been his sycophants and enablers. And look, I got a lot of friends of Republicans, and a lot of them aren't voting Republican this year for good reason, because that party has been hijacked. This is simply the Donald Trump Party, and the only option you have to bring some degree of restraint is the Democratic Party this year, and by gum, people are voting like crazy. We'll be okay. Thanks very much.
Anyone else like to add another nonpartisan comment?
I do want to say one thing, and your question is a perfect and legitimate question, but what gives rise to a pundit saying that Democrats are divided? That's an alternative reality. There is nothing you can point to in the primary season or anything that's happened in the last year that would indicate that Democrats are not unified. And yet you hear on a daily basis by quote-unquote experts and pundits that somehow we are divided. Democrats believe that everyone should have insurance, health insurance. Now, we may disagree on how we get there, but we all agree that everyone should have health care. We all agree that we need to do a bunch of other things, including making sure our environment's cleaner. Some people might want to... some people wanted to ban plastic straws last year. We're only getting around to doing it this year. But this idea that we're somehow divided has no basis in fact, and I defy people to point to it. Yes, people on further left have won some primaries, and lots of people further right have won primaries as well. We're Democrats. We're going to show up on Election Day.
Okay. All right, we're going to move to the audience, and this is being filmed and taped And it's live on public radio, so you need to wait for a microphone. I can't really see people very well, but we have someone right here in the second row. And we've got time, but let's keep the question short. Thank you.
Short. I was in New York as a banker on 9/11, three blocks from the World Trade Center. A few years later, we were in New Orleans, enrolling our daughter as a freshman at Tulane University when Katrina hit. When we got home after the hurricane, we thought about it a lot, and we both have one question to ask. How close and how prepared are you as governors with FEMA today in the event of a takeout of a major American city or municipality in your state to help those people not live through the mess that we at least experienced in New York on 9/11 and later on in New Orleans in Katrina? Thank you.
Well, I can start on that. I will tell you that FEMA today is a better agency, and it was under President Obama as well, than it was when Katrina hit. I can tell you we've invested unprecedented amounts of money in New Orleans. We've got the strongest levee system that we have ever had, the hurricane protection system. I won't tell you that everything is perfect. We still have turbines that generate power to run our pumps that are over 100 years old. They work most of the time, though. So we really do have our challenges, but we are better prepared today than we've ever been. And in 2016, 2 years ago, I flew in, had to immediately leave 56 of our 64 parishes. We don't have counties in Louisiana. We have parishes. But 56 out of 64 were declared major federal disaster because of the flooding that started the first day of our event here in Aspen. And I got to work with FEMA both under President Obama and now under President Trump. And I will just tell you that the agency is much better. Now, I know it had tremendous challenges down in Puerto Rico, and I'm not making excuses, and I'm really not casting blame either. But New Orleans, and by the way, come back, and you see it for yourself. It's a great city. The number one destination in the world, by the way, in 2018, it is 300 years old. So there has been some kind of government in New Orleans for 300 years. It may not be organized fully, but...
Okay, next, I'm going to need to rely on the mic runners a little bit. Right in the front row over here, and then I promise to get someone over on this side where I can't see them as well. Someone in the very back.
I've been listening to governors for the last 5 or 6 years here, as both Republican and Democrat, talk about their states and how successful, how creative they've been. I implore you guys, because you are creative, because you've done a wonderful job in a system, a democratic system, that can have a terrible national effect. But as far as you guys are concerned, you're doing something for your states. So I implore you to spend your time and your creativity, part of it, to get a national feel for the Democratic Party, which is lost. The Democratic Party hasn't said anything intelligent to its basic people for the last 15 years. It's up to you guys to come together and find...
Can you give us a question, please?
...and find a possibility, do something.
All right.
We like that part about applauding our creativity. Thank you very much.
All right, we have in the back over here.
Governor Edwards, your predecessor, Bobby Jindal, left you a colossal financial mess in your state, and... What have you been able to do to dig yourself out of that mess?
Well, that is a great question. I will tell you, more than a $2 billion deficit when I took office, and that's more than half of our discretionary state general fund. And despite that deficit that he left me, and by the way, he had inherited over $1 billion surplus, we still cut higher education more than any state in the nation in the 8 years he was governor. Well, I will tell you, we have stabilized the state of Louisiana. The revenue is stable for the first time in many years. The credit rating agencies are paying attention. They've actually took note and took us off the negative watch. We've invested in higher education. We fully funded it for the last 2 years in a row and only two times in 10 years. We fully funded our education, our TOPS program, which is our scholarship program, but we have more need-based aid for higher education at any point in our state's history. And this is leading to investment, job creation, and I will tell you that no state in the nation's unemployment declined more than ours. Last year, we have a 10-year low in unemployment, more people working in Louisiana today than any point in our history. GDP exceeded that of 35 states last year. So we are on a roll in Louisiana, and if you don't believe me, come down and see it. Come down spend and see money. It. And bring some money. That's right.
If we can have a microphone in the second row here. This gentleman's had his hand up a couple of times. Ah, very good idea, especially as we don't have any women up here. Next three questions will go to women only.
You've all talked about creating jobs in your state, and I wonder if you've heard of the concept of a federal job guarantee and whether you support it as something, as a way of taking creating jobs for everyone who wants one. I recommend you look into the federal job guarantee and modern monetary theory as a way of paying for the programs that all us Democrats support.
Okay. Just on a broader basis, I mean, it relates to criminal justice reform that we've talked about before, but you know, we've done a terrible job in preparing a workforce. And for what job do we prepare them for? I think in the United States for a long period of time, and in my state in particular, we thought that we would not be competitive in manufacturing. So we stopped training people to be participate in manufacturing years and years ago. And then we're surprised when all of a sudden we have a shortage of people to make jet engines or submarines or helicopters. I want everyone to have a job. And it's important to do, but there are some immediate things that we need to do, and that is to make sure that people have internships and apprenticeships, that they're getting a good high school education, regardless of what city their high school is located in, and that we're tuning our job preparation efforts to address what we can reasonably predict are going to be job growth areas, like digital media, like bioscience, like advanced manufacturing. You know, in Connecticut, I say, if you want to make something cheap, you're going to make it another state, but if you want to make it great, you're going to make it in Connecticut. And I can point to jet engines, submarines, and helicopters as proof.
All right, I'm going to rely on our mic runners because we can't really see anything other than a hand. Okay, great.
She who has the mic has the power here, right?
All right.
Governor Inslee, how do you really feel about Donald Trump, huh? I have a couple of questions, actually. One of them, I live in San Francisco when I'm not living here, and I love what you're all talking about. It sounds like I want to move to each of your states. I live in one of them part of the time, Governor Hickenlooper. But I walk out of my door. I live in a nice neighborhood, and I walk out of my door, and I see hypodermic needles right there. And they're all over San Francisco. And then there are the homeless. So on the local level, in a big city like San Francisco, where there is tremendous wealth, as everyone knows, and also tremendous poverty, I just sort of wonder how what you're doing is ever going to trickle down and in the end, maybe politically speaking, ever get one of you elected president, because who are you? You know, I just wonder if the real people are still, if their needs are being addressed. And then along those lines, there is a rumor, Governor Hickenlooper, that you might be joining the race in 2020. I'm wondering where you stand on that. And likewise, Mitch Landrieu, Governor Edwards, if you have any insight on Mitch Landrieu or any of the rest of you up there. So.
Well, let me, I'm not sure if that was addressed to me, but I'll tackle it. Look.
We're now hearing from Governor Hickenlooper's campaign manager, I think.
Well, we jointly have blown up the myth of trickle-down economics, and we have done it state by state. We have fundamentally demonstrated that the most successful way to grow your economy is to grow a vigorous middle class with family wage jobs.
And we have demonstrated time and time again that the progressive things we do to grow a middle class work in growing jobs. So in my state, where we have increased the minimum wage, where we have the best paid family leave policy in the United States, where we had some of the most successful rollout of the health care reform provision, where we are protecting pay equity for women, where the Republican trickle-down theory was that that would destroy your economy. And all of us in our states have shown that that trickle-down theory is a farce. So we've demonstrated success in this effort. We have also demonstrated a great irony that where you have great economic productivity, you end up with some problems that are extremely frustrated. So in my state, we've had the hottest economy in the United States for 3 years in a row, but we've had increased homelessness because we have 65,000 people moving into our state, many people who are of high-tech origin, driving up rents, and every time rents go up $100, our homelessness goes up 14%. So we have to understand that we need to make investments in that social safety net, and we have to be willing to do it. And all of these governors have been willing to do it. You look at Steve Bullock, had a creative idea about, you know, breakfast after the bell to make sure people have food in their bellies so that they're ready for schools. That's an economic growth issue in some regard. So I think we have demonstrated on a state-by-state basis, if you want your economy to grow, hire a Democrat. I'll stand on that anywhere on America.
And I think probably everyone in this room agrees we need a safety net and a good one. We're having a national epidemic of mental health, of people living in anxiety and despair. Whether you look in cities or whether you look in rural areas, you're seeing people that feel left behind, they feel no one cares. That is tied to exactly what you're describing, the fact that we stopped doing apprenticeships 30 or 40 years ago. If you look at Switzerland or Germany, you know, we've got a program here, we're in our third year of model on the Swiss side, where it's not just electricians and plumbers, but it's everybody. It's a bank, it's insurance companies, to make sure kids, when they're 17 or 18, and this doesn't matter what background they're from, they get a chance to learn what a job site is like, they get an income. You know, it's a three-year program. By the end of it, most of them live at home. They've got $12,000 or $15,000 in the bank. They've got a year's college credit. It's a real opportunity. And we've got a scholarship plan now statewide, so that in Denver Public Schools, we have now, in the last 10 years, doubled the number of Latino and African-American kids that are going to college. We've doubled their persistence through college, and we've reduced the dropout rate by 70%. That, I will argue, is the single way that we're going to answer that problem, is more training, better skills, and really focused on what are the jobs of tomorrow. The whole point of the apprenticeships is to help have each industry predict what these jobs are. And Zoe Baird is an active voice here with the Markle Foundation. Skillful.com has created a technical platform with the partnership of Microsoft, $26 million gift last summer, to be able to predict what are the professions that are going to vanish and begin training people before they've lost their jobs with the skills that they can move into a new profession. I mean, we've got to get so much better given the job location we're going to see, just automation and robots and artificial intelligence. We've got to do a much better job than we did in the 80s and the 90s.
Thank you. We do need to have a hard stop in a few minutes, but we have one last question.
So John Hickenlooper partly took this up. It's the opioid crisis. I would just love to hear, it is so much a result of the social conditions you mentioned, but we also need to invest now in treatment for people who are addicted, because just like people coming out of jail, it's not going to end unless we invest in preventing it. Sorry, that was a question.
I would agree. I think we all would. Certainly, and from the perspective of where we actually began this panel on healthcare, like the idea with Medicaid expansion, we dropped uninsured rate from 20% to 7%. But really, we also provided substance use and abuse counseling and availability for a whole lot of folks that otherwise weren't getting it. in a state like Montana, generally with opioids, oddly enough, I was attorney general for a governor. We peaked death-wise at 2009. We began by saying that this is a law enforcement issue, but it's also a public health issue. Opening up the opportunities for counseling, also trying to figure out ways where we could get, I mean, if you look in most people's medicine cabinets, we did one drug take back, there were glass pill bottles from 1952. You know, you tend to hoard these drugs. So getting rid of the overall supply. So we did public health, law enforcement, and supply. Long term, I think that there's a number of steps because it's not, as far as the amount being prescribed, isn't getting a heck of a lot better in so many areas. Well, we've squeezed it down in Montana. Now we're seeing meth increase. But many of our states, especially our, I think it's, interior states are really struggling with this.
Very important issue. So let's have a couple of comments from Governor Malloy and Governor Edwards.
So, you know, this is my eighth year and final year as governor. We've passed laws addressing the opioid crisis in 7 out of 8 sessions. And I think we've attempted to lead on this issue. But I want to share something with you, and I want to share something with my fellow governors who undoubtedly know this, but a few years ago, 5-6 years ago, we only had 7 people in Connecticut die of overdoses that had fentanyl in their system. 7. This past year, it was 700. You know, opioids always killed people, but fentanyl is the difference right now. And you know, if we could only if people suffering from mental illness, which I believe most drug addiction is. Could rationalize this. If you could have them understand that someone's putting poison in their poison, that's where we should start. Or if you're going to use an opioid, which is in itself a poison, but has some legitimate uses, I suppose, understand when you become addicted to it after 5 days, potentially, that the next thing that you, when you can no longer afford that form, you're going to go to the street and buy a poison that has a poison in it. And we were very slow to wake up as a nation to the threat of fentanyl, most of which is manufactured offshore and brought into the country. Having said that, you know, prescriptions played an unbelievable part of this debacle that we've seen. And quite frankly, we were producing doctors who had never received sufficient training in pain management. And by the way, most states still don't require that for a medical degree to know something extensive about pain management and what's an appropriate way to treat it. And the evidence of that on the dental side was when I got a tooth pulled as a kid, you were sent home, and at most you might take a couple of aspirin and you know be told to live with it. We had people, including young people, leave a dentist office with 30-day supply of an opioid. A 30-day supply. We now know that someone can become addicted in as few as 5 days.
Governor Edwards, if you can, brief, please.
I will be brief. First of all, those 471,000 people with Medicaid expansion, it does have behavioral health, which includes mental health and also addictive disorder treatment, inpatient and outpatient. And even though we have 470,000 more people with insurance covers that covers pharmaceutical benefits, there are fewer prescriptions being written today for opioids than there were before, and fewer pills being prescribed because we have limited the first-time prescription for acute pain to 7 days, and we created and strengthened the prescription monitoring program where the doctor has to look at it before they give that first prescription to make sure some other doctor hasn't recently prescribed opioids for that individual, because well over half of the people using heroin today started with prescription opioids. And so if we can stop the addiction there, hopefully it never progresses.
Ladies and gentlemen, great thanks for these 5 great leaders. Thank you.
Thanks so much for tuning in to Aspen Public Radio. That was the conclusion of the McCloskey Speaker Series. Live from the Aspen Institute, the Democratic Governors Panel, uniting a divided nation, starting with the states. Support for this live broadcast of the McCloskey Speaker Series comes from Penny Evans Carruth with Aspen Snowmass Sotheby's, opening doors for buyers and sellers in the Roaring Fork Valley. Learn more at pennycarruth.com. This discussion will be up on our website, aspenpublicradio.org. Support comes from Balcom & Green PC, serving the Roaring Fork Valley since 1953. Balcom & Green has been recognized for professional excellence by U.S. News on its Best Law Firms list. More information at 945-6546. From Picken County Landfill, reminding you to give your clothing and textiles a second life by recycling them at the landfill. Each year, Americans throw away an average of 70 pounds each of clothing and textiles. Learn more about recycling them at landfillrules.com. And from Smith Immigration, a full-service immigration firm working for individuals and businesses on marriage-based cases, removal defense, and work and investor visas. Learn more at 945-5111. I'm Allison Bechtesh. Thanks so much for making us part of your afternoon. We return now to All Things Considered, already in progress.